Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, August 17th. Sure is getting late in the summer. I can't even imagine how all that time went by. Welcome to Speak Up. We got a good show for you today. Peter R.H. will be joining us later in the hour. But we have a reprise interview with Taryn Scott of UBC, all about whales in our area. And we'll be getting to that in just a moment. Gardening with Embark with Pablo Vimas will be up at about the half hour mark. And Peter will be here later on talking about something we touched on last week's show, which was the press ganging. This used to happen, press ganging of civilians into fighting forest fires all the way up to about the 1960s. If you can imagine, you were just minding your own business. And next thing you know, you're on the fire line digging a ditch. Anyway, we got all that and more coming out for you on the program today, along with some good music and bird note. In the news for Vancouver today, and important for many people traveling to work and trying to get around, today is the first day of job action by unionized workers from TransLink's Coast Mountain Bus Company. Their job action is starting today. Fortunately, the actions that are starting today are just about, are mainly symbolic. Unionized bus drivers will not be wearing their uniforms today. Just part of a way to send a message to the employer about the fact that negotiations have not been moving forward. The union has rejected two offers from TransLink and now taking things to the next stage. This is typically how most of the transit disruptions that have happened make their start, and they escalate as they go along. Too early to say whether that's happening, and hopefully by starting with this, we'll see a resolution before it gets to something that we all really have to worry about. Anyway, tomorrow on Speak Up, Danny Nesvadarani will have an interview with an interview with someone from the union and a response from TransLink. So tune in tomorrow at 10 a.m. for that. This summer, we've seen a lot of whales around the Vancouver waterfront, even all the way up into Burrard Inlet and even False Creek. I was lucky enough to last weekend to see some humpback whales while paddleboarding off of Whitecliffe Park in West Vancouver. That was super exciting. We weren't right on top of them or anything. You know, they were probably at least half a kilometer to a kilometer away. But still, you know, seeing whales in the wild never gets old. And I haven't seen humpbacks for a long, long time. I've seen orcas sometimes from the shore or from the ferry and stuff like that. But seeing the humpbacks was pretty exciting. Joining me now is Taryn Scarf from UBC's Department of Zoology and a master's researcher looking at whales. How long have you been interested in whales, and how long have you been professionally studying them?
That's a great question, actually. I think I've loved whales for my whole life. I'm from a small town in BC where we don't have an ocean, but I would always come to Vancouver to visit my grandparents and see the whales here, and that's kind of where my love for them started. And I was fortunate enough during my undergraduate degree at UBC to work on a research project with the Marine Mammal Research Unit, starting to look at resident killer whales. And that was 7 years ago at this point. So back in 2019 was when I started. And I've just kind of continued on since then.
And so, for your master's research, you've been looking at whales and their movements around the area. Can you tell me a bit more about what you were researching?
Yeah, so for my master's, I was looking at the abundance and distribution of transient killer whales. So those are the mammal-eating killer whales around Vancouver. So anywhere from as far south as like Victoria all the way up to Port Hardy area. So looking at how many whales are spending time in this area, when are they spending the most time here, and how does that kind of link up with the prey that's available to them?
Right. So we've been seeing quite a number of whales right around our area recently, and different ones too, orcas and grays and humpbacks, all sort of near to Vancouver, which I don't, certainly in my experience living here, I mean, they come and go all the time, but it seems like there's a lot of them lately. What's been happening?
Yeah, there's so many more whales coming around Vancouver. So with the transient killer whales, I feel like there's a report at least once a week now, especially in the last month or so, of whales being seen under the Lions Gate Bridge, going up Burrard Inlet, in around English Bay. I mean, they'll come that close to the city, but then there's so many more just off in the Strait of Georgia as well, right? For the transient killer whales in particular, it's mainly more seals and sea lions for them to eat in this area, especially like heading up Burrard Inlet. There's a lot of harbor seal populations up there, so they've kind of figured out that's the hot spot to eat. The population itself is growing of the whales, so there's more whales. So we're just seeing a lot more of them here. For the gray whales, that's a more like new thing, especially for us in this area. Yeah, it's pretty rare for gray whales to actually come in this far towards a city, and kind of off their normal migration route. Down in Puget Sound, there is a local population that will spend some time there. But it's mainly just to come and feed on all the different species that we have in the area. So coming this close to shore, I mean, there's been so much cool footage of people being able to see the gray whale off of like Kitts Beach, which is super cool. And then with the humpbacks, there's just a rebound in their population. So they're doing really great. This is a traditional feeding ground for them, and they're just starting to come back in really big numbers, which is great to see year after year.
One of the things I was sort of mentioned in an article was how at one point the I think it was the humpback population was almost entirely wiped out on this coast, and there's sort of a theory that maybe with that happening, the knowledge, the community knowledge with the whales was kind of lost of where the good hunting grounds were.
Yeah, totally. I mean, back when whaling was still happening in Canada, the humpback population took a big hit during that time, and this used to be a traditional feeding ground for them. And so it's good to see them coming back here and finding new areas as well. I mean, yeah, they're kind of finding all these different little pockets of hot spots for food throughout the Salish Sea, and moving more northwards as well now.
Well, I imagine a river estuary sort of would, like a big one like the Fraser, would sort of tend to be a good spot for all the whales, for all
Yeah.
their sort of prey foods.
Totally. Yeah. It's a great spot for all their prey foods. And then in the case of the transients, the prey that they eat, right? So that's the Fraser is like a hot spot for all the different salmon species coming back, which the harbor seals love to feed on. And the transients have picked up on this. So that's why they're coming back to feed on those growing harbor seal populations.
So, I mean, part of what we're talking about here is, we're seeing more whales and some rebounding populations, but whale populations are also under stress as well. I mean, we've just another report, I think it was last week, of a I think it was a humpback, emaciated humpback washing up on the shore. And obviously, and that's been happening for a few years, where it appears they're not getting enough food. And we hear about the resident orca population also struggling. How do these, these sort of two sort of trends balance out, or what's happening there?
Yeah, it's really depends on what they eat, it seems to be, and the population of whales. So like In the example of the killer whales, we have the transients, who are the mammal-eating population, who are flourishing right now. There's more than 350 individuals in the population. They're growing. And I think because of what they eat, they have a pretty diverse menu from what they can pick from. They're doing really well, whereas especially the southern resident population, they're a very small population, only in the 70s, I believe. Like, their numbers fluctuates in the low 70s. But they are a fish eating population, so they're fully dependent, especially in the summer months, primarily on Chinook salmon. Not as much of that to go around potentially. Their menu isn't as diverse as the transients, so they're a little bit more limited in what they're willing to eat, which makes it difficult. And when a population's already struggling, they're kind of a little bit more susceptible to other threats. Whereas the transients, since they have so much to eat, they can just prey on anything. Similar with like the gray whales, I think they're one of the populations that's been being the ones found emaciated, super emaciated, and washing up on shore. And it's also, I believe, a food issue for them. And that's kind of why they're coming into this area. They need to restore those fat reserves and eat some more. It's because they're not able to make it the full way, which is concerning for sure. So it's, yeah, different menu items that they all eat really dictates how well the population does.
With the killer whales, I mean, they tend to be really social animals. They live in family groups and pods and stuff. So is the difference in their food preference? I mean, could that be described as a cultural issue almost? And is I'll let you answer that question first and then follow up.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, the two populations of killer whales diverged many, many, many years ago, and don't really have much genetic similarity between the two. And it is cultural, physiological potentially as well, just in what was available. But like, they don't interbreed between the two populations. And even in BC, we have the southern residents who are really struggling, have that low population number. But we also have the northern residents who kind of stay in the area of like Campbell River northward, and their population's doing pretty well. So they have a few hundred individuals in their population, but they also don't mix with the southern residents. And so they're very three separate groups who it would be great if they like genetically would breed together, but they all stay in their own areas.
Because I guess my next question was going to be if they could, one population could sort of learn from the other, but if they're not really even mixing it up, maybe that's not very likely.
Yeah, they avoid each other at all costs, really. There's very little observations of them overlapping at the same time and being seen in the same area at the same time. So it would be difficult, and there's, yeah, a lot of cultural and specializations that they've just been focused on that one food source for a long time.
How do current populations for all these whales today, how do they compare to what we understand or know about historical populations, particularly before Europeans showed up on the coast and started doing hunting and anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, for the transient killer whales, they historically have been known to be in this area. So that's a lot of the indigenous communities around Vancouver have shared stories of transient killer whales coming up into Burrard Inlet. So we're almost seeing, the rebalancing from the past, essentially, of having these populations come in post-colonization. Which is really cool to see. So, like, the orca whale really plays a significant role in Indigenous communities, and yeah, there's lots of stories of whales coming up Burrard Inlet, in particular with the killer whales, both residents and transients as well.
So what I know, what do we need to do, as residents here, but also our government at both levels, you know, to support these populations. I know some stuff has been done around ship traffic to try and limit that impact on whales. What are the things that need to happen to help these, particularly, I mean, I don't know what can be done to help the southern resident population recover, but, you know, for all the populations?
Yeah, there's kind of two veins. We have like the one where the whale populations are doing pretty well. So like the transient killer whales, the northern resident killer whales, humpback populations now. So I think the focus for them is making sure we keep their populations healthy. So making sure that they have enough food sources available, whether that's through like making sure there's abundant harbor seal and sea lion populations and other marine mammal species, as well as fish availability. So making sure that there's enough fish for the humpbacks to prey on. Yeah. And then for the residents, like the other vein where we have these struggling populations more. So we have the southern resident killer whales and then the gray whales who are showing up emaciated. It's, I think a lot more research really needs to go into figuring out what is the exact root cause. I don't think in any population, there's one specific reason that is leading to the struggles in these populations. There's probably a number of things. So figuring out what those things are, and then, like you mentioned, acting on them. So how there was some vessel traffic reductions, the government just put in place, where vessels have to stay even farther from whales now. So measures like that really help, looking at how sound impacts them. And then, of course, the food availability. So taking a look at all the different factors that could potentially be negatively impacting these populations, and finding a solution for them while also ensuring that we keep the healthy populations healthy.
So people love to see whales. You know, and people get so excited, you know, when the opportunity comes up. What are some tips for how to find them and how to do it safely?
Yeah, I also love seeing whales. I have also lived in Vancouver for many years now, and I've never been able to see a killer whale very close to Vancouver. Mine have been more towards Vancouver Island. But if you're one of the lucky ones, it's a really great experience. So if you're going to be on land, there's a few key areas where they like to go. So like I mentioned, they've been traveling up Burrard Inlet the last month or so. That seems to be a bit of a hotspot for them, especially we're coming into the summer months. This is when they're here the most and we have the most individuals available or present in the area. So your chances of seeing one are the highest through the summer months. So going through up in Burrard Inlet, off Lighthouse Point in West Vancouver is often where people will go. And you can also sometimes see the humpbacks off there. The humpbacks won't come up in towards Burrard Inlet as much. There is a land-based whale watching guide that was put out by the Orca Man, who's a local Vancouver resident, and that's a great solution to look at. If you're on the water searching for whales, it's just to look for those spouts. That's the best way to see them, especially if they're at a far distance. You want to just see their blow come up into the air. And from there, you'll be able to kind of follow where they're going and track them.
Yeah. The other trick is riding the ferry a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've been fortunate on a lot of the ferry rides. I've been able to see killer whales, especially, and humpbacks as well. And yeah. So yeah, if you want a higher chance, ride the ferry a few times a day. Yeah.
So you've finished your master's now. Are you hoping to continue working with whales?
Yeah, so I'm working a lot more in fisheries work in BC. So yeah. I worked on a project after my master's looking at how much salmon is available for the southern residents. So that'll be a paper coming out in the next year or so. And that kind of got me into the world of salmon and looking at fisheries work and how important the fisheries are as well for the whales. So continuing on with that and finishing up some of these ongoing projects. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. Taryn Scarf, who's a recent master's graduate from UBC's Department of Zoology. And whale researcher.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for talking to me today.
This is Bird Note. Osprey are impressive birds of prey with a wingspan more than 5 feet across. They primarily eat fish. And this bird is delivering a fresh catch to his mate and chicks. Osprey pairs construct large, open stick nests, and they'll keep adding new material year after year. An established nest can get up to 6 feet wide and 12 feet tall. While the ospreys only occupy the upper portion of this structure, other birds take up residence below. For decades, researchers have observed small songbirds raising their young inside active osprey nests. Cavity nesting species like house sparrows and European starlings seem right at home in the stick structure's nooks and crannies. This unexpected living arrangement is a classic example of a survival strategy called protective nesting. Nesting birds, be they songbirds or raptors, must always be on the alert for egg-eating predators. But with pescatarians in the penthouse suite, the nest's smaller tenants get 24-hour security without ending up on the menu themselves. And if a raccoon dares to approach, they'll make sure the ospreys hear about it. There's nothing quite like a good neighbor. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Everyone has their role in challenging HIV stigma. We do this together for each other. HIV is not who you are. It's something you can navigate with strength and courage. The drum is the sound of healing and the heartbeat we share.
For more information about living well with HIV, visit startinghomefires.ca.
Diving into a vinegar sea. I'm in. I'm DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
Pablo Vimas is here because it's time for Gardening with Embark. Thanks for joining us, Pablo.
Pleasure to be here.
Pablo is, of course, from Embark Sustainability and our weekly gardens expert. Week 33, I believe.
Oh, yes. Wow. Week 33. And we are the gardeners, and particularly in my case, looking for week 36, where this campus will be open. Mm-hmm. I'm welcoming new students. I'm welcoming everyone who is returning for completing their studies.
And
we in the garden are in the last leg for the summer. It's like a summer has been very warm, sunny, bright, with little storms. Crops have done very well, and now is the time to start crossing those crops, harvesting everything what's left, and moving into a fall mood now.
a little time of change and transition.
It's a time of transition. So at the moment, if you still have potatoes, starting to harvest them, dig them from the ground and make a space for that ground to grow new vegetables that like cold weather, like broccoli, cauliflower, spinach, arugula, Asian greens. If the tomato plants, in our case, our tomato plants have went all bushy, lots of shy shoots, but no flowers and no fruits.
Oh, very disappointing.
Very disappointing. So again, shall I wait another month, another 15 days? Why to wait another 15 days? So immediately we just remove, chop it, goes into the compost, all the biomass, prepare the space, and we can continue planting beets, carrots, turnips, which are lovely. They love this cold weather that's coming.
So it's sort of, you know, a situation like that, it's just better to cut your losses and get a start on what you can make happen for the fall with your fall crops.
Yes, correct. Yeah, so because at the moment, if the tomato plant has not big tomatos hanging from the plant, it's no point to continue waiting. And radishes, very quick, they will come to plant and you will harvest very quick.
So just quickly, what causes that? You know, why didn't the tomatoes work for you this year?
That's a good question. We had a warm weather, lovely sun. We had keep watering, and somehow the tomatoes didn't make it.
Sometimes that's just how it goes.
Sometimes that's how it goes. We say is a tomato year, is a zucchini year. We made all the best to ensure that the soil is lots of nutrients for the season, but somehow all the nature and the environment haven't come together for the plant to say, I'm happy and I'm going to produce. So things go like that.
That's part of being a gardener, right?
Correct. And that's why the garden never repeats. That's why the garden is, this year will be different from the last year, and the coming year will be completely different. So that's why it keeps us gardeners always engaged with the garden, because we don't know how is the environment, the weather is going to, and the conditions of the garden are going to meet to produce.
Right.
Yeah. But we'd like to have a scientific explanation why these tomatoes didn't grow.
Yes.
And there is no lack of bees or anything. The garden is full of insects.
Yeah.
And
of course, I can see over there that many other plants and crops are thriving. So.
Thriving, yeah. Yeah. So tomatoes this year was our best crop. So we harvest everything that is ready. So we have beets and carrots still from the spring. So